other angry whores discuss what threats were made before. We don't need them anymore. You know more than I know. You know more than I know. You know more than I know. Instead, I read the morning news in bed. What endlessness ahead, and there's no more to be said. You know more than I know. You know more than I know. You know more than I know. The blind may see, but stay behind relief of all liability and greed. And there's nothing more.
Once again, listening to A Thunder Perfect Mood. I am your host, Marie Moon, here on WMFO Medford 91.5. We return with part two of Dune. Last week, we read about Paul's engagement with Begum Jabbar. This week we move forward. Once again, I am reading this in kind of a book club style, so it's not consecutive. I'm jumping ahead about 60 pages here to when Jessica meets the Shoutout Meeps. It's pretty great. And then I'll jump forward once again to page 65, where I said we would, you know, find each other this week. But that Mape scene, I couldn't not read that. It's so good. You can learn more about our comprehensive plan on thunderperfectmood.com. You can reach out to me on Twitter at Marie Moon, WMFO. That's M-A-R-I-E Moon, WMFO. Say hi. We begin.
Mm-hmm. With the Lady Jessica and Arrakis, the Bene Gesserit system of sewing implant legends through the Missionaria Protectiva came to its full fruition. The wisdom of seeding the known universe with a prophecy pattern for the protection of BG personnel has long been appreciated, but never have we seen a condition ut extremis with more ideal mating of person and preparation. The prophetic legends had taken on Arrakis even to the extent of adopted labels, including Reverend Mother, Kanto, and Rispandu, and most of all, the Sharia Panoplia Propheticus. And it is generally accepted now that the Lady Jessica's latent abilities were grossly underestimated. From Analysis, The Arrakine Crisis, by the Princess Irulan. All around Lady Jessica, piled in corners of the Arrakine Great Hall, mounded in the open spaces, stood the packaged freight of their lives. Boxes, trunks, cartons, cases, some partly unpacked. She could hear the cargo handlers from the guild shuttle depositing another load in the entry. Jessica stood in the center of the hall. She moved in a slow turn, looking up and around at shadowed carvings, crannies, and deeply recessed windows. This giant anachronism of a room reminded her of the sisters' hall at her Bene Gesserit school. But at the school, the effect had been of warmth. Here, all was bleak stone. Some architect had reached far back into history for these buttressed walls and dark hangings, she thought. The arched ceiling stood two stories above her, with great crossbeams she felt sure had been shipped here to Arrakis across space at monstrous cost. No planet of this system grew trees to make such beams, unless the beams were imitation wood. She thought not. This had been the government mansion in the days of the old empire. Costs had been of less importance then. It had been before the Harkonnens and their new megalopolis of Carthage, a cheap and brassy place some 200 kilometers northeast across the broken land. Leto had been wise to choose this place for his seat of government. The name, Arrakine, had a good sound, filled with tradition. And this was a smaller city, easier to sterilize and defend. Again there came the clatter of boxes being unloaded in the entry. Jessica sighed. Against a carton to her right stood the painting of the Duke's father. Wrapping twine hung from it, like a frayed decoration. A piece of the twine was still clutched in Jessica's left hand. Beside the painting lay a black bull's head mounted on a polished board. The head was a dark island in a sea of wadded paper. Its plaque lay flat on the floor, and the bull's shiny muzzle pointed at the ceiling as though the beast were ready to bellow a challenge into this echoing room. Jessica wondered what compulsion had brought her to uncover these two things first, the head and the painting. She knew there was something symbolic in the action. Not since the day when the Duke's buyers had taken her from the school has she felt this frightened and unsure of herself. The head and the picture. They heightened her feelings of confusion. She shuddered, glanced at the slit windows high overhead. It was still early afternoon here, and in these latitudes the sky looked black and cold, so much darker than the warm blue of Caladan. A pang of homesickness throbbed through her. So far away, Caladan. Here we are. The voice was Duke Leto's. She whirled, saw him striding from the arched passage to the dining hall. His black working uniform, with the red armorial hawk crest at the breast, looked dusty and rumpled. I thought you might have lost yourself in this hideous place, he said. It is a cold house, she said. She looked at his tallness, at the dark skin that made her think of olive groves and golden sun on blue waters. There was wood smoke in the gray of his eyes, but the face was predatory, thin, full of sharp angles and planes. A sudden fear of him tightened her breast. He had become such a savage, driving person since the decision to bow to the Emperor's command. "The whole city feels cold," she said. "It's a dirty, dusty little garrison town," he agreed. "But we'll change that." He looked around the hall. "These are public rooms for state occasions. I've just glanced at some of the family apartments in the south wing. They're much nicer." He stepped closer, touched her arm, admiring her stateliness. And again, he wondered at her unknown ancestry. A renegade house, perhaps? Some black-barred royalty? She looked more regal than the Emperor's own blood. Under the pressure of his stare, she turned half away, exposing her profile. And he realized there was no single and precise thing that brought her beauty to focus. The face was oval, under a cap of hair the color of polished bronze. Her eyes were set wide, as green and clear as the morning skies of Caladan. The nose was small, the mouth wide and generous. Her figure was good, but scant, tall, with its curves gone to slimness. He remembered that the lay sisters at the school had called her skinny, so his buyers had told him. But that description oversimplified. She had brought a regal beauty back into the Atreides line. He was glad that Paul favored her. "Where's Paul?" he asked. "Someplace around the house, taking his lessons with Yue."
Probably in the south wing," he said. "I thought I heard Yue's voice, but I couldn't take time to look."
He glanced down at her, hesitating.
"I came here only to hang the key of Caladan Castle in the dining hall."
She caught her breath, stopped the impulse to reach out to him. Hanging the key, there was finality in that action. But this was not the time or place for comforting. "I saw our banner over the house as we came in," she said. He glanced at the painting of his father.
"Where were you going to hang that?"
"Somewhere in here."
"No."
The word rang flat and final, telling her she could use trickery to persuade, but open argument was useless. Still, she had to try, even if the gesture served only to remind herself that she would not trick him. "My lord," she said, "if you'd only..."
"The answer remains no. I indulge you shamefully in most things, not in this. I've just come from the dining hall, where there are..."
"My lord, please."
"The choice is between your digestion and my ancestral dignity, my dear," he said. "They will hang in the dining hall."
She sighed. "Yes, my lord."
"You may resume your custom of dining in your rooms whenever possible. I shall expect you at your proper position only on formal occasions."
"Thank you, my lord."
"And don't go all cold and formal on me. Be thankful that I never married you, my dear. Then it'd be your duty to join me at the table for every meal."
She held her face immobile, nodded.
"Hawat already has our own poison snooper over the dining table," he said. "There's a portable in your room."
"You anticipated this disagreement," she said.
"My dear, I think also of your comfort. I've engaged servants. They're locals, but Hawat has cleared them. They're Fremen all. They'll do until our own people can be released from their other duties."
"Can anyone from this place be truly safe?"
"Anyone who hates Harkonnens. You may even want to keep the head housekeeper, the Shadout Mapes."
"Shadout," Jessica said, "a Fremen title?"
"I'm told it means well dipper, a meaning with rather important overtones here. She may not strike you as the servant type, although Hawat speaks highly of her on the basis of Duncan's report. They're convinced she wants to serve, specifically that she wants to serve you."
"Me?"
"The Fremen have learned that you're Bene Gesserit," he said. "There are legends about the Bene Gesserit here."
The Missionaria Protectiva, Jessica thought. No place escapes them. "Does this mean Duncan was successful?" she asked.
Will the Fremen be our allies?
There's nothing definite, he said. They wish to observe us for a while, Duncan believes. They did, however, promise to stop raiding our outlying villages during a truce period. That's a more important gain than it might seem. Hawat tells me the Fremen were a deep thorn in the Harkonnen side, that the extent of their ravages was a carefully guarded secret. It wouldn't have helped for the Emperor to learn of the ineffectiveness of the Harkonnen military.
A Fremen housekeeper, Jessica mused, returning to the subject of the shout-out Mapes. She'll have the all-blue eyes.
Don't let the appearance of these people deceive you, he said. There's a deep strength and healthy vitality in them. I think they'll be everything we need.
It's a dangerous gamble, she said.
Let's not go into that again, he said.
She forced a smile. We are committed, no doubt of that. She went through the quick regimen of calmness. The two deep breaths, the ritual thought, then. When I assign rooms, is there anything special I should reserve for you?
You must teach me someday how you do that, he said. The way you thrust your worries aside and turn to practical matters. It must be a Bene Gesserit thing.
It's a female thing, she said.
He smiled. Well, assignment of rooms. Make certain I have a large office space next to my sleeping quarters. There'll be more paperwork here than on Caladan. A guard room, of course. That should cover it. Don't worry about the security of the house. Hawat's men have been over it in depth.
I'm sure they have.
He glanced at his wristwatch. And you might see that all our timepieces are adjusted for Arakeen Local. I've assigned a tech to take care of it. He'll be along presently. He brushed a strand of her hair back from her forehead. I must return to the landing field now. The second shuttle's due any minute with my staff reserves.
Couldn't Hawat meet them, my lord? You look so tired.
The good Thufir is even busier than I am. You know this planet's infested with Harkonnen intrigues. Besides, I must try persuading some of the trained spice hunters against leaving. They have the option, you know, with the change of fife. And this planetologist, the Emperor and the Landsrat installed as judge of the change, cannot be bought. He's allowing the opt. About 800 trained hands expect to go out on the spice shuttle, and there's a guild cargo ship standing by.
My lord, she broke off, hesitating.
Yes?
He will not be persuaded against trying to make this planet secure for us, she thought. And I cannot use my tricks on him. At what time will you be expecting dinner? She asked.
That's not what she was going to say, he thought.
Ah, my Jessica, would that we were somewhere else, anywhere, away from this terrible place. Alone, the two of us, without a care.
I'll eat in the officer's mess at the field, he said. Don't expect me until very late. And, I'll be sending a guard car for Paul. I want him to attend our strategy conference.
He cleared his throat as though to say something else, then, without warning, turned and strode out, headed for the entry where she could hear more boxes being deposited. His voice sounded once from there, commanding and disdainful, the way he always spoke to servants when he was in a hurry.
The Lady Jessica's in the Great Hall. Join her there immediately.
The outer door slammed. Jessica turned away, faced the painting of Leto's father. It had been done by the famed artist, Alba, during the old Duke's middle years. He was portrayed in matador costume, with a magenta cape flung over his left arm. The face looked young, hardly older than Leto's now, and with the same hawk features, the same gray stare. She clenched her fists at her sides, glared at the painting. Damn you, damn you, damn you, she whispered.
What are your orders, noble-born?
It was a woman's voice, thin and stringy. Jessica whirled, stared down,
at a knobby, gray-haired woman in a shapeless sack dress of bondsman brown. The woman looked as wrinkled and desiccated as any member of the mob that had greeted them along the way from the landing field that morning. Every native she had seen on this planet, Jessica thought, looked prune dry and undernourished. Yet Leto said they were strong and vital. And there were the eyes, of course, the wash of deepest, darkest blue without any white, secretive, mysterious. Jessica forced herself not to stare. The woman gave a stiff-necked nod, said, "I am called the Shadout Mapes, Nobleborn. What are your orders?" "You may refer to me as my lady," Jessica said. "I'm not Nobleborn. I'm the bound concubine of the Duke Leto." Again, the strange nod, and the woman peered upward at Jessica with a sly questioning. "There's a wife?" "There is not, nor has there ever been. I am the Duke's only companion, the mother of his heir designate." Even as she spoke, Jessica laughed inwardly at the pride behind her words. "Was it, Sandor Augustine said?" she asked herself. "The mind commands the body, and it obeys. The mind orders itself and meets resistance." "Yes, I am meeting no resistance lately. I could use a quiet retreat by myself." A weird cry sounded from the road outside the house. It was repeated. And then... and again. "Only a water seller, my lady. But you've no need to interest yourself in such as they. The cistern here holds 50,000 liters, and it's always kept full." She glanced down at her dress. "Why, you know, my lady, I don't even have to wear my still suit here," she cackled. "And me not even dead." Jessica hesitated, wanting to question this Fremen woman, needing data to guide her. But bringing order of the confusion in the castle was more imperative. Still, she found the thought unsettling that water was a major mark of wealth here. "My husband told me of your title, Shedout," Jessica said. "I recognize the word. It is a very ancient word." "You know the ancient tongues, then?" Mapes asked. And she waited with an awed intensity. "Tongues are the Bene Gesserit's first learning," Jessica said. "I know the Botani Jib and the Chikobsa, all the hunting languages." Mapes nodded. "Just as the legend says." And Jessica wondered, "Why do I play out this sham?" But the Bene Gesserit ways were devious and compelling. "I know the dark things and the ways of the Great Mother," Jessica said. She read the more obvious signs in Mape's actions and appearance, the petite betrayals. "Misesis pregia," she said in the Chaksuba tongue. "Andral trepera, trada shikbushkari mishekes parakri." Mape's took a backward step, appeared poised to flee. "I know many things," Jessica said. "I know that you have borne children, that you have lost loved ones, that you have hidden in fear, and that you have done violence, and will yet do more violence. I know many things." In a low voice, Mape said, "I meant no offense, my lady." "You speak of the legend and seek answers," Jessica said. "Beware the answers you may find. I know you came prepared for violence with a weapon in your bodice." "My lady, I..." "There's a remote possibility you could draw my life's blood," Jessica said. "But in doing so, you'd bring down more ruin than your wildest fears could imagine. There are worse things than dying, you know. Even for an entire people." "My lady," Mapes pleaded. She appeared about to fall on her knees. "The weapon was sent as a gift to you, should you prove to be the one." "And as the means of my death, should I prove otherwise," Jessica said. She waited in the seeming relaxation that made the Bene Gesserit trained so terrifying in combat. "Now we will see which way the decision tips," she thought.
Slowly, Mapes reached into the neck of her dress, brought out the dark sheath. A black handle with deep finger ridges protruded from it. She took sheath in one hand and handle in the other, withdrew a milk-white blade, held it up. The blade seemed to shine and glitter with a light of its own. It was double-edged, like a kindle, and the blade was perhaps 20 centimeters long. "Do you know this, my lady?" Mapes asked. It could only be one thing, Jessica knew, the fabled kris knife of Arrakis, the blade that had never been taken off the planet and was only known by rumor and wild gossip. "It's a kris knife," she said. "Say it not lightly," Mapes said. "Do you know its meaning?" And Jessica thought, there was an edge to that question. Here's the reason this Fremen has taken service with me, to ask that one question. My answer could precipitate violence, or what? She's called Shadout in the Chakobsa tongue. Knife, that's Death Maker in Chakobsa. She's getting restive. I must answer now. Delay is as dangerous as the wrong answer. Jessica said, "It's a maker."
"Aye!"
Mapes wailed. It was the sound of both grief and elation. She trembled so hard the knife blade sent glittering shards of reflection shooting around the room. Jessica waited, poised. She had intended to say the knife was a maker of death, and then add the ancient word. But every sense warned her now, all the deep training of alertness that exposed meaning in the most casual muscle twitch. The key word was maker. 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 Still, Mapes held the knife as though she were ready to use it. Jessica said, "Did you think that I, knowing the mysteries of the Great Mother, would not know the Maker?" Mapes lowered the knife. "My lady, when one has lived with prophecy for so long, the moment of revelation is a shock." Jessica thought about the prophecy, the Sharia, and all the Panoplia Propheticus, the Bene Gesserit of the Missionaria Protectiva dropped here centuries ago. Long dead, no doubt, but her purpose accomplished. The protective legends implanted in these people against the day of a Bene Gesserit's need. Well, that day had come. Mapes returned knife to sheath, said, "This is an unfixed blade, my lady. Keep it near you. More than a week away from flesh, and it begins to disintegrate. It's yours, a tooth of Shai Hulud, for as long as you live." Jessica reached out her right hand, risked a gamble. "Mapes, you've sheathed that blade unblooded." With a gasp, Mapes dropped the sheathed knife into Jessica's hand, tore open the brown bodice, wailing, "Take the water of my life!" Jessica withdrew the blade from its sheath. How it glittered! She directed the point toward Mapes, saw a fear greater than death panic come over the woman. Poison in the point? Jessica wondered. She tipped up the blade, drew a delicate scratch with the blade's edge above Mapes' left breast. There was a thick welling of blood that stopped almost immediately. Ultra-fast coagulation, Jessica thought. A moisture-conserving mutation? She sheathed the blade, said, "Button your dress, Mapes." Mapes obeyed, trembling. The eyes without whites stared at Jessica. "You are ours," she muttered. "You are the one." There came another sound of unloading in the entry. Swiftly, Mapes grabbed the sheathed knife, concealed it in Jessica's bodice. "Who sees that knife must be cleansed or slain," she snarled. "You know that, my lady." "I know it now," Jessica thought. The cargo handlers left without intruding on the great hall. Mapes composed herself, said, "The uncleansed who have seen a kris knife may not leave Arrakis alive. Never forget that, my lady. You have been entrusted with a kris knife." She took a deep breath.
Now the thing must take its course. It cannot be hurried.
She glanced at the stacked boxes and piled goods around them. And there's work aplenty to while the time for us here.
Jessica hesitated. The thing must take its course. That was a specific catchphrase from the missionary protectivist's stock of incantations. The coming of the Reverend Mother to free you.
But I'm not a Reverend Mother, Jessica thought. And then, Great Mother, they planted that one here. This must be a hideous place.
In matter-of-fact tones, Mape said, What'll you be wanting me to do first, my lady?
Instinct warned Jessica to match that casual tone. She said, The painting of the old Duke over there, it must be hung on one side of the dining hall. The bull's head must go on the opposite wall of the painting.
Mapes crossed to the bull's head. What a great beast it must have been to carry such a head, she said.
She stooped.
I'll have to be cleaning this first, won't I, my lady?
No.
But there's dirt caked on its horns.
That's not dirt, Mapes. That's the blood of our Duke's father. Those horns were sprayed with a transparent fixative within hours after this beast killed the old Duke.
Mapes stood up. Ah, now, she said.
It's just blood. Old blood, at that. Get some help hanging these now. The beastly things are heavy.
Did you think the blood bothered me? Mapes asked. I'm of the desert, and I've seen blood aplenty.
I see that you have, Jessica said.
And some of it my own, Mapes said. More than you drew with your puny scratch.
You'd rather I'd cut deeper?
Ah, no. The body's water is scant enough without gashing a wasteful lot of it into the air.
You did the thing right. And Jessica, noting the words and manner, caught the deeper implications in the phrase, the body's water. Again, she felt a sense of oppression at the importance of water on Arrakis.
On which side of the dining hall shall I hang which one of these pretties, my lady?
Mapes asked. Ever the practical one, this Mapes, Jessica thought.
She said, Use your own judgment, Mapes. It makes no real difference.
As you say, my lady, Mapes stooped, began clearing wrappings and twine from the head.
Killed an old duke, did you? She crooned.
Shall I summon a handler to help you? Jessica asked.
I'll manage, my lady.
Yes, she'll manage, Jessica thought. There's that about this Fremen creature, the drive to manage. Jessica felt the cold sheath of the kriz knife beneath her bodice, thought of the long chain of Bene Gesserit scheming that had forged another link here. Because of that scheming, she had survived a deadly crisis.
It cannot be hurried, Mapes had said.
Yet there was a tempo of headlong rushing to this place that filled Jessica with foreboding.
And not all the preparations of the Missionaria Protectiva, nor Hawat's suspicious inspection of this castellated pile of rocks, could dispel the feeling.
When you've finished hanging those, start unpacking the boxes, Jessica said. One of the cargo men at the entry has all the keys and knows where things should go. Get the keys and the list from him. If there are any questions, I'll be in the south wing.
As you will, my lady, Mapes said.
Jessica turned away, thinking, Hawat may have passed this residency as safe, but there's something wrong about the place. I can feel it. An urgent need to see her son gripped Jessica. She began walking toward the arched doorway that led into the passage to the dining hall and the family wings. Faster and faster she walked until she was almost running. Behind her, Mapes paused in clearing the wrappings from the bull's head, looked at the retreating back.
She's the one, all right, she muttered. Poor thing.
Some velvet morning when I'm straight, how she gave me life, and how she made it in some velvet morning when I'm strange.
Flowers grow.
We're listening to Some Velvet Morning by Lee Hazelwood and Nancy Sinatra. Before that, A Question of Blood by Jean-Michel Jarret, collaborating with John Carpenter. Zero Gravity by Jean-Michel Jarret, collaborating with Tangerine Dream. Riz Ortolani Senza Pieta, I'm sorry for my pronunciation. Number 3 by Aphex Twin. Leaves Expanded, etc. from the Upstream Color soundtrack. The track Gin by Simeon Project. And we opened with You Know More Than I Know by John Cale. This is a Thunder Perfect Mood on WMFO Medford. We are reading Dune.
Speed with which Muad'Dib learned the necessities of Arrakis. The Bene Gesserit, of course, knew the basis of this speed. For the others, we can say that Muad'Dib learned rapidly because his first training was in how to learn. And the first lesson of all was the basic trust that he could learn. It is shocking to find how many people do not believe that they can learn, and how many more believe learning to be difficult. Muad'Dib knew that every experience carries its lesson. From The Humanity of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. Paul lay on the bed, feigning sleep. It had been easy to palm Dr. Yue's sleeping tablet, to pretend to swallow it. Paul suppressed a laugh. Even his mother had believed him asleep. He had wanted to jump up and ask her permission to go exploring the house, but had realized she wouldn't approve.
things were too unsettled yet. No, this way was best. If I slip out without asking, I haven't disobeyed orders, and I will stay in the house where it's safe. He heard his mother and Yue talking in the other room. Their words were indistinct, something about the spice, the Harkonnens. The conversation rose and fell. Paul's attention went to the carved headboard of his bed, a false headboard attached to the wall and concealing the controls for this room's functions. A leaping fish had been shaped on the wood, with thick brown waves beneath it. He knew if he pushed the fish's one visible eye, that would turn on the room's suspensor lamps. One of the waves, when twisted, controlled ventilation. Another changed the temperature. Quietly, Paul sat up in bed. A tall bookcase stood against the wall to his left. It could be swung aside to reveal a closet with drawers along one side. The handle on the door into the hall was patterned on an ornithopter thrust bar. It was as though the room had been designed to entice him. The room and this planet. He thought of the film book Yue had shown him. Arrakis, His Imperial Majesty's Desert Botanical Testing Station. It was an old film book from before discovery of the spice. Names flitted through Paul's mind, each with its picture imprinted by the book's mnemonic pulse. Saguaro, Burrowbush, Date Palm, Sand Verbena, Evening Primrose, Barrel Cactus, Incense Bush, Smoke Tree, Creosote Bush, Kit Fox, Desert Hawk, Kangaroo Mouse. Names and pictures, names and pictures, from man's tyrannic past. And many to be found now nowhere else in the universe, except here on Arrakis. So many new things to learn about the spice and the sandworms. A door closed in the other room. Paul heard his mother's footsteps retreating down the hall. Dr. Yue, he knew, would find something to read and remain in the other room. Now was the moment to go exploring. Paul slipped out of the bed, headed for the bookcase door that opened into the closet. He stopped at a sound behind him, turned. The carved headboard of the bed was folding down onto the spot where he had been sleeping. Paul froze, and immobility saved his life. From behind the headboard slipped a tiny hunter seeker, no more than 5 centimeters long. Paul recognized it at once, a common assassination weapon that every child of royal blood learned about at an early age. It was a ravening sliver of metal, guided by some nearby hand and eye. It could burrow into moving flesh and chew its way up nerve channels to the nearest vital organ. The seeker lifted, swung sideways across the room and back. Through Paul's mind flashed the related knowledge, the hunter-seeker limitations. Its compressed suspensor field distorted the vision of its transmitter eye. With nothing but the dim light of the room to reflect its target, the operator would be relying on motion, anything that moved. A shield could slow a hunter, give time to destroy it, but Paul had put aside his shield on the bed. Laser guns would knock them down, but laser guns were expensive and notoriously cranky at maintenance, and there was always the peril of explosive pyrotechnics if the laser beam intersected a hot shield. The Atreides relied on their body shields and their wits. Now, Paul held himself in near catatonic immobility, knowing he had only his wits to meet this threat. The hunter-seeker lifted another half meter. It rippled through the slatted light from the window blinds, back and forth, quartering the room. I must try to grab it, he thought. The suspensor field will make it slippery on the bottom. I must grip tightly. The thing dropped a half meter, quartered to the left, circled back around the bed. A faint humming could be heard from it. Who is operating that thing? Paul wondered. It has to be someone near. I could shout for Yue, but it would take him the instant the door opened. The hall door behind Paul creaked. A rap sounded there. The door opened. The hunter-seeker arrowed past his head toward the motion. Paul's right hand shot out and down, gripping the deadly thing. It hummed and twisted in his hand, but his muscles were locked on it in desperation. With a violent turn and thrust, he slammed the thing's nose against the metal doorplate. He felt the crunch of it as the nose eye smashed and the seeker went dead in his hand. Still, he held it to be certain. Paul's eyes came up, met the open stare of total blue from the shout-out Mapes. "Your father has sent for you," she said. "There are men in the hall to escort you." Paul nodded, his eyes and awareness focusing on this odd woman in a sack-like dress of bondsman brown. She was looking now at the thing clutched in his hand. "I've heard of such like," she said. "It would have killed me, not so." He had to swallow before he could speak. "I was its target. But it was coming for me." "Because you were moving." And he wondered, "Who is this creature?" "Then you saved my life," she said. "I saved both our lives." "Seems like you could have let it have me and made your own escape," she said. "Who are you?" he asked. "The Shoutout Mapes, housekeeper." "How did you know where to find me?" "Your mother told me. I met her at the stairs to the weirding room down the hall." She pointed to her right. "Your father's men are still waiting." "Those will be Hawat's men," he thought. "We must find the operator of this thing." "Go to my father's men," he said. "Tell them I've caught a hunter-seeker in the house, and they're to spread out and find the operator. Tell them to seal off the house and its grounds immediately. They'll know how to go about it. The operator's sure to be a stranger among us." And he wondered, could it be this creature? But he knew it wasn't. The seeker had been under control when she entered. "Before I do your bidding, Manling," Mape said, "I must cleanse the way between us. You've put a water burden on me, that I'm not sure I care to support. But we Fremen pay our debts, be they black debts or white debts. And it's known to us that you've a traitor in your midst. Who it is, we cannot say, but we're certain sure of it. Mayhap there's the hand guided that flesh cutter." Paul absorbed this in silence. A traitor. Before he could speak, the odd woman whirled away and ran back toward the entry. He thought to call her back, but there was an air about her that told him she would resent it. She told him what she knew, and now she was going to do his bidding. The house would be swarming with Hawat's men in a minute. His mind went to other parts of that strange conversation. Weirding room. He looked to his left where she had pointed. We Fremen. So that was a Fremen. He paused for the mnemonic blink that would store the pattern of her face in his memory. Prune-wrinkled features, darkly browned. Blue-on-blue eyes without any white in them. He attached the label, the Shoutout Mapes. Still gripping the shattered seeker, Paul turned back into his room, scooped up his shield belt from the bed with his left hand, swung it around his waist, and buckled it as he ran back out and down the hall to the left. She'd said his mother was someplace down here. Stairs. A weirding room. We'll be right back.
Third Floor Hallway by Fabio Frizzi, who was before that, preceded by Unreal Sounds, also by Fabio Frizzi, great Italian soundtracksman, and before that, Hoffner Dawn by John Carpenter. That was Dune, Part 2. So much to discuss, so much happening. Next week, we will begin with part 3. I am diverging slightly from the thing I linked on the website, thunderperfectmood.com, which is annoying. I guess I'll make my own. We're going to read up until page 146. That's in the version of Dune that I'm reading. Again, there are no chapters. The version of Dune I'm reading has a black cover with a like thin vertical rectangle of sand, perhaps the titular dune. So on page 146, we're going to read up until the section that begins, "There is no escape, we pay for the violence of our ancestors," from the collected sayings of Muad'Dib by Princess Yulamon. I gotta say, I don't know if y'all out there have seen the recent motion picture called Dune. I really missed Princess Irulan floating in space. That was nice. She was just there to expose the plot. She was looking out for us. Good night, everyone. It's been real nice this week. You have been listening to A Thunder Perfect Mood every Thursday at 9 p.m. I am Marie Moon. You are listening on WMFO Medford 91.5. I wish you well. See you next week.
I learned patience from my adoptive dad. All he had to say was,
"Hey, you got this. Just breathe." Hey. Hey, we're pretty good.
Yeah.
Might have to start a band.
I got it.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
So artificial, what should I